have things in my life that regularly remind me that I'm a part of a bigger story. Things that every time I experience them or do them, just roots me in a bigger reality. It reminds me that there's this epic, grand thing that's happening in the world, and I'm just a small part of that. One of those for me is every time I look at the cosmos. Do you ever have that feeling when you look at the cosmos, at the moon or at the sun? All the pictures we saw in that video are from the Hubble Space Telescope. Those are real pictures of things that exist in our galaxy, that exist in galaxies upon galaxies that make up this universe. And every time I see a sunrise or a sunset, I'm reminded that I'm a part of something way bigger than myself. You know, every time I look at the moon, I like to do this. My 2.5-year-old son loves looking at the moon. And so on a clear night, I'll take him and I'll hold him and we'll just look at the moon. And he always says the same thing. He says, "Daddy, can I hold it? Can I hold it?" He just, even in him, there's something drawing him to this bigger reality that he sees around him. And that's the story that we want to dig into over these next 8 weeks. The next 8 weeks are really about looking at the grand, epic narrative story of God and finding our place in the midst of that story, because that story is powerful and God has revealed it to us in order to shape how we think about him and how we think about our lives. And today we're going to start in an interesting place. You know, if you open up the Bible, the very first sentence you'll see is, "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth." And oftentimes, that's where the story begins for us. But today, we're actually going to look at what does the Bible have to say about life before the beginning? Does it say anything about what was going on in the mind of God, in the life of God, before the beginning of time? Because where and how you start a story shapes the story that you're telling. It shapes where the story might be going. And that's what we're going to explore. And I'm personally really excited about the next 8 weeks, about this series, because this concept of the story of God, the idea that we can engage really in this thing that's playing out, has deeply shaped me and changed me in the last 2 years. And it's because of a friend that I made 2 years ago that completely messed my life up. I don't know if you've ever had a friend like this that messed up your life in a good way. Totally flipped the script on how I think about story. Totally flipped the script on how I think about God. Totally flipped the script on how I think about the Bible. And it's changed me significantly and deeply. And it's my friend Jeremy. Jeremy put together a 10-week foundational experience for people who are following Jesus. Foundational experience he calls the Story Form Life. And in going through that a couple years ago with some folks on staff, I was kind of, you know, I didn't really have big expectations. I've been through things similar to that before, kind of Christianity 101 basic Bible stuff. And I'm like, okay, this will be good. And, it'll be accurate. But I wasn't expecting it to change my life. And it did. It changed me. It changed me deeply. And the biggest reason I think it changed me is because I got to do life with Jeremy. And I got to see this guy who has wired his whole life around this story. Just deeply living out the reality of the story in his life. He's structured his family in such a way that he and his wife are able to take their kids on very little notice anywhere in the world and plop down and engage other people in this story of God. And that's the mission that they have as a family, that they want to be a multi-generational mission for their family. And he's gotten that out of his insight of the story. Out of the story for him flows how he thinks about his marriage. It flows how he thinks about raising his kids. It flows how he thinks about the job he has or the job he doesn't have. And it's just powerful to me. And all of this happened for Jeremy because somebody messed him up. Somebody messed him up and said, "Hey, this idea of the story is the way that God wants us to make disciples. This is a command that Jesus gave to the church, to go and make disciples." And what that means is to engage people in the story of God that Jesus is fulfilling, and how does it look to shape their whole worldview around the reality that Jesus came to usher in. What does that look like on a practical basis? And this thing has been changing me deeply. It's changing how I think about everything. And why can all that happen just from a story? Well, quite simply, it's because all of us are story formed. We are all story formed already. There's a story we believe that deeply shapes the world for us. It shapes good, it shapes evil, it shapes what's right, it shapes what's next in our lives. This is the power of story. Anthropologists say that 70% of everything we learn as human beings, we learn through story. We are story-formed people. It is how we are wired. We are wired to be shaped by story. Story guides all our major decisions. For some of us, think back to high school. When you were in high school, if the story was about success and achievement and maybe earning enough income to be independent, then for you in high school, it was really important to focus on the SAT and the ACT because the next step was to get into the best college you could get into because that's what the story was about for you. For others of us, the story was about adventure. And while maybe we did focus on the SAT and the ACT, we set that to the side for a year so we could travel abroad, so we could take that backpacking trip across Europe that we always wanted to take. Because for us, it wasn't just about achievement, it was about adventure, and that shaped our choices. It guided every major decision that we've made in our lives. It's guiding whether or not you're married, whether or not you're having kids, what you do for a living. There's a story that we all live out of, and it guides major decisions in our lives. It shapes us. It forms us. It also galvanizes our community. The story you believe, I'd be willing to bet you, is the same story that is shared by the people you spend most of the time with. People tend to gather around others who share their view of the world, who share their view of the story that's playing out in the world around us. We're all this way. This is another thing I observe if I think about high school for me. I went to Central High School in Philadelphia, and there were lawns where people hung out in school, and you could tell the story people believed by what lawn they hung out on. So we had the South Lawn. And the South Lawn, they called themselves the South Lawn Committee. And the South Lawn Committee was where the goth kids hung out, and it was where the rocker kids hung out. And it wasn't just one race, it was diverse, but it was a bunch of kids who all believed kind of the way culture was the way they were going. It was this the cultural expression that they valued and connected to. And that flowed deeply out of the story of their lives, what they saw themselves as, how they saw themselves in the bigger context of the world. And then you had the East Lawn. And the East Lawn at Central was like the United Nations plopped down in Philadelphia. I mean, you could go on the East Lawn and not hear English at all. You might hear Eastern European languages or Asian languages or African languages because this is where international students and exchange students all gathered together. They galvanized as a community because they had a similar story, a story of being not from the United States, a story of being international and having another culture that dominated their life and coming into a new culture. And so they all hung out on the East Lawn. And then there was the North Lawn, and the North Lawn was where I hung out with my friends. And the North Lawn was, you know, pretty much dominated by people who were in the hip-hop culture at that time. So you'd go on the North Lawn, and you'd hear freestyle rapping, and you'd hear beatboxing, and you'd hear the latest songs that were out, because that was the story that was shaping us. And again, it wasn't about race, because the best rapper in my school growing up was Korean, and he was awesome. He was the best rapper in school. So it wasn't about that, but there was a story that drove us to the communities that we felt most comfortable in, the communities where we settled in. This is the power of story in our life. It guides our decisions. It galvanizes our community, and it also governs our emotional reactions. It governs our reactions. I saw last Friday the movie, The King's Speech. Anybody seen that? Great movie. Great, great movie. I really, really enjoyed the movie. Powerful for me. It's the story of a king. He was the king of England at the time of World War II, and he had a serious speech impediment. And so it's the story of a mentor who comes into his life and helps him overcome that impediment. And that was a powerful relationship, and I got a lot out of that part of the movie. The thing that struck me even more deeply, though, was his relationship with his children. I mean, here's a guy who, because of his speech impediment, struggled to tell his two girls bedtime stories at night because he couldn't get the words out. And every day when he would come home, his kids just loved him. They just received him, and they understood the challenges their dad had, but he was their father, and they loved him. And there's this point in the movie where he's become the king of England. And he has on all his royal kingly stuff. And he comes in, and probably because they have been coached that your dad now represents more than just being your father, these kids, instead of running to their dad and hugging him like they had done every other experience in the movie that we saw, instead they kind of stood at a distance and they curtsied him. They kind of just formally recognized his crown. And at that point in the movie, this dad, with the weight of the world on his shoulders, not knowing if he's going to be able to lead his country because of this impediment of speech that he has, in all of that royal garb, he just gets down with his kids and he hugs them and he loves them. And he just wants them to know, it doesn't matter what everybody else says I am your father first and I love you. And man, at that point in the movie theater, the wind shifted and my eyes started watering and I'm like, and I'm crying. I'm like, what is going on? Why does that impact me that way? Well, it's because now that I'm a father, I can't look at any scene of a father loving his kids and not cry. My wife teases me about this all the time now because it's like, I'm just a set. But it's because it's flowing out of the story that I'm experiencing and it's governing my emotional reaction. So when I see a father loving his kids, man, I just tear up. I can't help it. It just hits me deeply. We've all maybe experienced this. If you've traveled to another country, you may have experienced how your emotional reactions change when that country becomes a part of your own story. You know, you might talk about people from another country stereotypically or maybe buy into some of the off-color jokes that many people tell about folks from another country. But do you ever notice after you've gone to that country, you take offense at the same things that maybe you used to say? Because now there's relationship. Now you know people there. It's no longer just this nebulous country, but you think about specific names of people that you're doing life with, and it changes how you view people from that country. I think this is a very common thing. In Cincinnati, I would say, there's a country that, as my experience has gone in Cincinnati, people tend to discriminate against. In this city, I don't fully understand all the dynamics, but I just realized I would be in conversations and people would talk about folks from this country and they'd talk about strange cultural norms that they have and they would talk about things they did on the weekend. They would talk about their language even. And I began to kind of buy into this stereotypical view of people from this country. Until one day I actually crossed 75 and went to the West Side for myself. And I realized there are great people on the West Side. I love the West Side of Cincinnati. I do. And it just changes your view when you have relations. Some of my best friends live on the West Side of Cincinnati. I mean, it's like that kind of thing. You know what I mean? It just changes how you think about things. This is the power of story. It shapes us. It guides our decisions. It governs our emotional reactions. And it really impacts us deeply. In fact, I'm going to do a social experiment right now. Because there is a story that has shaped probably everyone in this room. And it's the dominant story or a dominant story in our lives. It's the American story. There is a real American story that governs our lives. And just to try this out, you know, I went to a church growing up where when the person was talking on stage, people would like call stuff out to them. So it's not uncommon for me to have that happen. I'm comfortable with that. And I want to do that right now. I actually want you guys to think about what are some words that come to mind when you think about themes in the American story. Throw some out to me. Freedom. Freedom, I heard it first. I've heard it first at every service this weekend. Freedom. Freedom comes out early because freedom is core to the identity of the American story, is it not? Is it not? We all value freedom. Freedom shapes how we view the events happening in the Middle East right now. It shapes how we view Libya. It shapes how we view what happened in Egypt because we have this deep value of freedom that's part of the American story. How about over this side? And give me another one. Patriotism. Patriotism is another one that comes up regularly. We value patriots. We value patriotism in this country. We do not look highly on people who aren't patriots in this country. We have concerns about that. That's a core part of our story. Give me another one. Diversity. I heard diversity. That's a fresh one. The melting pot, right? America is the melting pot. So many people, I mean, you know, how many movies have you seen that when they describe America, when they describe the story, they're coming through Ellis Island and they're going toward the Statue of Liberty. Give me, you're tired, you're worn, you're weary. That is a part of the American story. Now, here's what's interesting. We could go on and on with this, but what strikes me is even though we all grew up in different parts of this country, even though we didn't grow up in the same family, there are some core through lines to the American story that have shaped our lives. All of us are formed by this story. This is another place where Jeremy kind of messed me up because he talked about kind of the implications of the American story and how deeply it shapes us. So I want to share with you guys an American story. It's a cheesy slideshow. I'll share it with you. So like every story, the American story has to start in the beginning. So in the beginning of your American story, you were first a gleam in your mother and father's eyes. You became a little bit more. And at the result of that, beautiful baby you comes into the world. Now, your parents love you. They are living the American story. And part of the American story is you want to give your kids the best education possible to give them the most opportunity possible. So your parents begin to do things like buy My Baby Can Read when you're two, and no two-year-old needs to read, but they'll buy it anyway. And then they buy you more things, more books, books upon books. You go to the best middle schools. You go to the best private schools. You go to college. Maybe you go to graduate school. Why? Because in the American dream, you need money. That's right. You've got to make money if you're going to live out the American dream. Why do you need this money? Well, if you're a guy, maybe you want one day to find one of these. You want a wife. You would need money for a wife. And so then you get married in the American story. Then you and your beautiful wife move to a beautiful house with a white picket fence. You got to have the white picket fence. And why do you need the white picket fence? Because it's a safe environment within to raise your 2.5 children. 2.5 American children. Now, you love these children. You nurture these children. But after 18 years, it's very important these children get up out the house. So you move those children up out the house so that you and your wife can really live the American dream, which is sell your house, downsize, move to the beach, retire on the beach, play golf every day, hang out with your grandkids every day. And this is the pinnacle of the American story, because pretty much after that, you die. So that's the American story. That is the American story. This is the story that shapes us. Now, it's fun to poke fun at that. I actually laughed the first time I saw that. And then after that, I thought about this. Isn't it true that most of the things that stress us right now are the places where our life isn't lining up with that story? I mean, isn't it true that right now, if relationally we're not where we thought we would be on that track, it's a point of stress for us? It's a point of angst for us? Isn't it true if we're not financially where we thought we should be, educationally where we thought we should be, we struggle with that? This story shapes us very deeply. Isn't it true that some of our greatest joys are when, for some reason, life aligns and we're where we thought we would be at this point? We feel so good about that. And so the thing is, this story has shaped us deeply. It influences us every day. It influences your decisions. It influences your relationships. It influences your mission in life. And I think it's a fair question to ask, is the American story even true? Is it real? See, because truth has to be true for all people at all times, across all spectrums. And then when I apply that to the American story, is it true? Is it true? And here's why it's important to ask that question, because truth can never be absorbed apart from the story. That's why, even if it isn't true, we're still living that, because truth apart from the story is impossible to grasp, because story always wins. In your life and in my life, story always wins. The story, I believe, will win over any pragmatic truth you may choose to offer me. And maybe that's why. Maybe that's why this book, the Bible, is 80% story, 80% narrative. Because story always wins. And if there is a God, and if he is writing a story in our hearts, and if we're part of a bigger story, then it would make sense that he would use the very way he's wired us to communicate to us. And he would do that through a story. And just like every story, this one speaks volumes from the very first sentence. So let's read that. It says, "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth." In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. You know, the more I think about that first sentence of the story, the more I think it should prompt some questions in us. And I think one of the questions it should prompt in us is the question I see modeled by another character in the story that I love, the Lord of the Rings. I love the Lord of the Rings. Can't wait to read this with my kids. And in the Lord of the Rings, in the Two Towers, there's a place where Frodo, the hobbit, and Sam, his closest friend, another hobbit, are traveling to Mordor. And the fellowship has broken up at this point, and they are on their own, and they're walking through difficult, difficult times. And in the midst of that, they're reflecting on their situation. They're reflecting on their surroundings. And it says this, "I don't like anything here at all," said Frodo. "Step or stone, breath or bone, earth, air, and water all seem accursed, but so our path is laid." To which his friend, Samwise Gamgee, ask a very, very helpful question. He says, "I wonder what sort of story we've fallen into." See, when we read those words, "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth," it should prompt that question in us. Just what sort of story have we fallen into? Because the story God is telling, we enter that story in act 3 of a 4-act play. Could you imagine if you went to see a play, 4 acts, and you've seen Act 1, you've seen Act 2, but I haven't. And I come on the stage in Act 3 and assume I don't need to know anything about what this play has been about for Acts 1 and 2. I've got my own lines. I've got my own approach to how I'm going to do this thing. Can you imagine how odd I would look on stage? It is utterly important for me to know what's come before, because this is the story I'm entering into. And this is what the Bible is describing when it says, "In the beginning, God created." In the beginning, there was a God who existed before the beginning of time. So man, if there was a prologue, if there was a prequel, if there was something that could help us understand a little bit more about the story we step into in Act 3, it would really be helpful. And it turns out there actually is there is a prologue of this story. It shows up in one of the biographies of Jesus' life. The book of John, chapter 1, verse 1 says, "In the beginning," there are those words again, "was the Word. And the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning." And you'll notice that Word is capitalized. This is a proper name. This is talking about a being. This isn't talking about a concept, but a being. It says, "Through him," through this Word, "all things were made. Without him, nothing was made that has been made. In him was life, and that life was the light of men." And then it goes on to say, "The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us." This word, this is a word that is being used for Jesus. This is a proper name that John, writing this prologue, is giving to Jesus, and he's describing an eternally existent Jesus. Not just a Jesus that shows up on the scene in the first century, but an eternally existent God who's always been, who's always existed, who's existed in relationship with the Father. There's some interesting things we can learn about before the beginning from just the words of that prologue. The first is that before the beginning, God was here. Before the beginning, God was already here. And it says that the Word was with God and the Word was God. There was a union, there was a relationship between Father and Son and Spirit. This is the core teaching in Christian faith of the Trinity, and that this is a relationship that God existed in from the beginning of time. He's timeless. There's a place in the Bible where some words are ascribed to God. It says, "Now to him who is eternal, immortal, and invisible." Eternal means he doesn't have a beginning and he doesn't have an end. I can't wrap my mind around that because I do have a beginning and I will have an end. And so does everything that I see around me. But this God is outside of the context of time. He's eternal. He's also immortal. And that means that he is timeless. He's ageless. And actually, the fact that he's immortal ties into this idea that he's invisible. There is a spiritual component to who he is. He is a spiritual being. And so even in his power, I couldn't grasp it with my limited human faculties. And this is the God who before the beginning existed. And this God before the beginning was perfect. He was complete, meaning he didn't lack anything. Not just he was not bad, he wasn't evil, he was good, but he was also not lacking anything. He was perfectly content in and of himself. Perfectly content in and of himself. There was a loving union, and it says that in him was life, and that life was the light of men. He was not only just in a loving union, but he was in a life-giving union. He actually, out of the generosity of the life he had, created. It was a generous act in which God created because there was a life-giving union in him. He was happy. He was perfect, and God was happy. Has been for all time. He's never lacked anything. This is how Meister Eckhart, a German theologian, talks about this. He says, "We were born out of the laughter of the Trinity." I love that. We were born out of the laughter of the Trinity. It was out of God's joy, out of his abundance that he created, because eternally, before time ever began, he was already complete. He was already happy, but out of the generosity of that happiness, he chose to create. He chose to involve other people in his happiness. And that's another thing. This God has been creative since before he said, "Let there be light." That wasn't his first creation. God has been eternally creative. There's a place in the story that captures what it would be like to have a front row seat at God's creativity from before the world began up to and including his creation of mankind. And this is one that I've asked them not to put on the screens because I think it would be helpful as we root in this story this first week to use different senses at different times. I just want you to listen to this, and I want you to imagine, what's the picture that comes to mind? What would it be like to experience this? This is from the book of Proverbs, chapter 8. "The Lord brought me forth as the first of his works, before his deeds of old. I was appointed from eternity, from the beginning, before the world began. When there were no oceans, I was given birth. When there were no springs abounding with water, before the mountains were settled in place, before the hills, I was given birth. Before he made the earth or its fields or any of the dust of the world, I was there. When he set the heavens in place, when he marked out the horizon on the face of the deep, when he established the clouds above and fixed securely the fountains of the deep, when he gave the sea its boundary so the waters would not overstep his command, when he marked out the foundations of the earth, then I was the craftsman at his side. I was filled with delight day after day, rejoicing always in his presence, rejoicing in his whole world and delighting in mankind." These words are attributed to a person, a character called wisdom, Again, wisdom with a capital W. It shows up as a proper name. Was this someone that was accompanying God in the creative process? Is this maybe another word for Jesus and the wisdom that has always existed that co-created the world with God? We see in the story that this God has always been creative. He has always existed in a perfect union. He has always been happy, and God has always been in community. God's community existed not just of the Trinity, but it also existed of angelic beings. He created beings, spiritual beings, before he ever created the physical human world that we see in the earth. We see this in the pages of the Bible where it says that the angels were actually cheerleading him on as he created the world. So God existed in community. In the narration we saw at the beginning, we heard this described as the throne room of God, and where these angels who've existed for long before the world ever began, they stand in the presence of God and they worship him, they praise him every day, saying, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty, who was, who is, and who is to come." And, you know, I grew up thinking about that image a lot, and I always used to think, man, what a boring job. Like, time until time, never ending, no lunch break, no coffee break. All these angels do is sit before God and say, "Holy, holy, holy, Lord God Almighty." And I was like, man, that's a really bummer job. I don't know that I would actually enjoy that. And I was in church, and people would preach to me, and they would say, "And this is what awaits you when you go to heaven. When you go to heaven, you're going to join the angels for eternity, and you're going to sing before the presence of God, and you're going to worship God." And I used to say, if that's the case, heaven sounds so boring. Oh my gosh, it sounds like what we do in this church. Oh my God, I gotta do that forever? And what I realized was I was missing something in that. I was missing something because I know this from my own experience. You know it from your own story. Whenever you experience pleasure, whenever you experience something that blows you away, don't you naturally praise it? Don't you naturally say to people, "Have you seen The King's Speech? Great movie. You got to go see that movie. Have you been to Charleston, South Carolina? Have you ever visited that? Oh, it's an awesome city. Here's all the things that you can do in Charleston." We naturally praise things that bring us joy and bring us pleasure. And so what that did is it changed the story for me. And what I now understand is this: the angels are in the presence of a completely perfect, completely loving, completely happy, fully generous, highly creative God. And what I see in terms of their response is the natural response of what they're enjoying. They're praising because of a response of enjoying God, and that changed the story on heaven for me. That changed the story on how God has always existed, how he exists right now, and what he's inviting me into, I believe, at the end of my story, is this place that is not this tedious, task-driven, you've got to bow down and worship God, but heaven is probably more like the best black family reunion you've ever been to. That's what heaven is probably like. Now, I don't assume everybody here has been to a black family reunion, so let me explain it to you. A black family reunion is basically a week-long or weekend-long party where you're related to everybody at the party. It's awesome. It is off-the-hook fun. I mean, it is the best thing I can think of. And so for me, what that means is in heaven, God must have a huge grill, like the biggest one you can get from Frontgate. He's got to have that huge grill. And on this grill, God has some spare ribs that he has been marinating in a rub for eons. I mean, it's been sitting in the fridge forever. And God's got these ribs. He's got burgers and dogs for the kids. But God has the best barbecue sauce you have ever tasted. And God is at this grill, and he's flipping burgers. He's probably flipping to a beat. He's jamming. He's having a good time. He's got a chef hat on. God has an apron on. And you know what? He's taking a break from the grill every now and then to play some spades and bidwhist, which he always wins. God always wins at spades and bidwhist. He always wins at those card games because God is having a party up in heaven. It is a blast. And if this is what heaven is like, then the only soundtrack that makes sense is the one from The Elements of Earth, Wind, and Fire, September. It's got to be September playing up in heaven. Badia, say, do you remember? Badia, it's got to be. Never was a cloudy day in heaven. That's got to be the soundtrack. Philip Bailey is singing in heaven right now. That's what I believe. So this is what heaven is. And what I see when I look at this is, okay, if this is what it's like in the presence of a perfect God who eternally has been happy, who eternally has been loving in union, and who is generatively and creatively inviting us into it, well, then that's a God I'm interested in understanding. That's a God of the story I'm interested in knowing. That's different for me. And this is what God has always existed in. There's no beginning to this for God, and there's no end to this for God. This is who he is. This is the main character in the story. See, we've stepped into someone else's story. We're not the main character in this story. God is the main character in this story, and we are entering into someone else's story. And man, if this is all there was to the story, this world would be an incredible place. But look around you. Look around you. Obviously, there has to be some other part to this story. As we look at suffering, as we look at loss, as we look at pain in our own lives, something happened. And just like every story, this one had a tragic turn.
Interior heaven, moments before the fall of Lucifer. An angel more beautiful than all the rest, the morning star, grows jealous of the praises given to the king.
I will raise my throne above the stars of God. I will make myself like the Most High.
A war in heaven breaks out. Archangel Michael and God's angels fight against Lucifer. He and the angels he has corrupted fight back. Lucifer is not strong enough and he loses his place in heaven. He is hurled to the earth and his angels with him.
You were the model of perfection, full of wisdom and perfect in beauty. You were blameless in your ways till wickedness was found in you. Your heart is now proud and your wisdom corrupt because of your splendor. I will drive you out in disgrace from the Mount of God. I expel you.
Lucifer is enraged and makes war against those who obey God's commandments and hold to the testimony of Jesus. The dragon stands on the shore of the sea, and the Spirit of God hovers over the waters.
The story says of the first fall, you were the model of perfection, full of wisdom and perfect in beauty. You were in Eden, the garden of God. Every precious stone adorned you, ruby, topaz, and emerald, chrysolite, onyx, and jasper, sapphire, turquoise, and beryl. Your settings and mountings were made of gold. On the day you were created, they were prepared. You were anointed as a guardian cherub. It's another word for an angel. For so I ordained you. You were on the holy mount of God. You walked among the fiery stones. You were blameless in your ways from the day you were created till wickedness was found in you. Through your widespread trade, you were filled with violence and you sinned. So I drove you in disgrace from the mountain of God and I expelled you, O guardian cherub, from among the fiery stones. Why? Because your heart became proud on account of your beauty. And you corrupted your wisdom because of your splendor. So I threw you to the earth. I made a spectacle of you before kings. See, the story clearly tells us that before the beginning, God was opposed. God was opposed. There was a created being, an angel of light he's called, Lucifer, also known as Satan, also known as the devil, who actually was created by God, existed in the presence of God, but wanted what was only God's to have, ultimate authority and ultimate praise. He wanted all of the worship that was being laid at the feet of God. He wanted it at his feet. And so he rebelled. And in that rebellion, a third of all the angelic beings that God created rebelled with him. And God cast them away and hurled them to the earth, it says in the story. And in that story, it also means that then this opposition is active in the earth. And actually, the whole mission of this angel, this fallen angel, is to convince us that God is not who he says he is, that God is not trustworthy, that someone else is worthy of our worship, so that we join him in this rebellion against a perfect, loving, complete, and holy God. And see, this is the part of the story that if we ignore it, if we act like it's just a fairy tale, we do that to our own detriment. Ignoring the reality that God was opposed, the reality that you have an enemy, is the same as ignoring the reality of vacationing in Normandy Beach on June 6th, 1944, as opposed to vacationing there on June 5th, 1944. See, on June 5th, 1944, maybe Normandy was a great place to be. It was a beach, it was comfortable, you could take your family there, and this was an awesome beach in France where you could experience time with your family, kids wading in the water, enjoy yourself. But man, if you went to Normandy Beach on June 6th and expected the same thing, you would have led your family to their death. because on June 6, 1944, it was D-Day. It was the day the Allied troops stormed the beach at Normandy, and it was a big, bloody battle in World War II. And if you ignored that reality, you would have died. And yet, it's easy to ignore the reality that we have an enemy, that there's someone who actually wants to oppose us, who has opposed God, and that we live in a war zone now. This world is a war zone. That's why there's suffering. That's why there's brokenness. That's why things don't work the way they're supposed to, is because this world is a war zone, because God has been opposed. God has been opposed. And our story, just like every story, is shaped by what comes before. So we have to come up to the beginning of the story. We have to come up to Genesis 1:1 with an understanding that things have happened before the beginning. Before the beginning, God was here, and he was perfect, and loving, creative. And out of the community he had, he generatively created the world so that we could share in that with him. And yet, there was an enemy. And so, when we read these words at the beginning of the story in that context, they start to bring back that question that Samwise Gamgee asked, just what sort of story have we fallen into? So let's read again Genesis 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now the earth was formless and empty. Darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. And the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. And the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. I've always looked at these words as the first act, the first step of creation. But maybe, based on what happened before the beginning, this is actually the first act of redemption. Maybe what God is doing when he brings form to a formless world, when he brings out of the void something that has design and function and beauty, maybe he's actually redeeming, because what I see in this and through other passages in the story is that God has always been redeeming. Before the beginning, God was redeeming. Before the beginning, he had redemption on his mind. God has always had redemption on his mind. Otherwise, there's a passage in the Bible that says that the Lamb of God was slain before the foundations of the world. The Lamb of God being Jesus, paying a cost for our sin. It says that happened before the foundations of the world. Well, that doesn't make any sense if God was somehow caught off guard by this rebellion. But if God in his mind, in his infinite mind, was able to work through a redemption plan, even in the midst of what could go wrong, then all of a sudden, it tells me something about this character in the story. It says he has a plan. It says that creation is going somewhere, and God has not been caught unaware, and in fact, he is working out a redemption plan in our midst. How does he do that? How's that going to play out? Well, that's where we're going in this story. That's where we're going next week. That's where we're going in the weeks to follow. But this hope that God has a plan kind of became very practical to me when I think about an experience my wife and I had with her OB during our first pregnancy. A couple weeks ago, I talked about how she went into preterm labor at 20 weeks with Nathan, and Nathan's fine. We had the baby fine. But at that point in the story, I remember how my whole story changed on obstetricians. See, before that time of the preterm labor, my story on obstetricians went like this. I mean, basically, I don't know if you've ever accompanied a woman to a pregnancy visit. If you are a pregnant woman or have been a pregnant woman, you've been to one of these. You know how these work. And this is how they work, basically. You go into the office, and maybe the doctor's been delivering babies the night before, or whatever it is. They're typically late, and so you're waiting for a little bit. And you're waiting in the office, and then they call you back. And when they call you back, it's the same routine. They take your wife, they weigh your wife, they tell your wife to go pee in a cup, they take her blood pressure and all that stuff. They put you in a room as the husband, and then you wait some more. You wait a couple more minutes, the doctor comes in. The doctor has this fancy schmancy device that he takes out, helps him hear the baby's heartbeat. You do that, you get really excited. He looks at you and says, "Do you have any questions?" You say, "No." He says, "Great, I'll see you next month." And I remember going to these visits and saying, why was it again I didn't go to medical school? Like, I could do that. I think I can handle that, you know? And then I'm getting these bills, and I'm like, man, what are we paying this guy? Like, we should be paying a nurse. Maybe she should be getting paid, but I don't know. But anyway, so this was kind of my mindset until the visit we had after the preterm labor. Our doctor was actually out of the country at the time. He was on vacation, and when he came back, we had a visit with him, kind of a follow-up visit. And I remember sitting in his office with Maria, and I remember him flipping through the chart and looking at all kinds of things that had happened and what had been done at Christ Hospital. And at a certain point, he put the chart down, and he said, "Hey, you know, I knew that when we started this journey, there was a chance that we could have some complications. And I just want the two of you to know, I've got a couple other tricks up my sleeve." You want to talk about changing the story? When he said those words, I said, you know what? Whatever we paid him, it's not enough. We need to pay this man more. Because it is so reassuring when you don't know what's coming next to have someone who has more insight, more understanding, more skill, more ability to affect the situation look you in the eyes and say, hey, I've got a plan. And this is what God is saying in the midst of this story. In the midst of Genesis 1 and all through the story, God is saying, no matter what the world looks like, hey, I got a couple other tricks up my sleeve. I've got a plan. 1 Corinthians says it this way. No eye has seen, no ear has heard, no mind has conceived what God has prepared for those who love him. But God has revealed it to us by his Spirit. That's why we spent 8 weeks on this story, because this is not a clever man-made tale. This is a story given to us directly from the Spirit who was hovering over the waters in a redemptive role. This Spirit of God is communicating to us, hey, God has a plan. And we want to engage in that in the midst of this series. I'm going to invite the band to come out, and we're just going to have a chance to respond a little bit through music and just say to God, you are a mystery. This story is way bigger than us, and yet you want to reveal some things to us, and we're up for understanding more of who you are and where history is going through the story that you're writing, the story we get to be a part of. And so as we sing these songs, we're going to take up an offering. It's going to be a time to be generous. And if you're here for the first time, I would say, hey, glad you came. You came on a great week. We're kicking off an awesome series, and I hope you come back. And when this bag comes, you can just let it pass you right on by. We're not about your money. We just want you to have an experience where you can encounter this story and encounter the God of this story. So when the bag comes, you can let it pass you right on by. And let me also say this. I know that when it's dark and we're singing, it's an easy time to slip out. But today, you'll want to stick around. We have an incredible game change announcement we're going to be sharing on the other side of singing. So let's all stand. We're going to sing some songs to respond to the God of the story. Now, I'm glad you stayed. And the reason you stayed is because we have an incredible update, game change update, that Brian, our senior pastor, is going to share via video with you. And it's well worth the wait. So let's take a look at this.
You know, the reason why we do what we do here at Crossroads is Crossroads connects seekers to a community of growing Christ followers who are changing the world. That's what we've done for 15 years, and that's what we want to do for the next 30 years. We just got done with the campaign in terms of raising money, the Game Change campaign, which is a 3-year commitment we made above and beyond what we regularly give. However, even though it was a 3-year financial commitment, we're making decisions here at Crossroads now that are about the next 30 years. I'm making decisions right now to say, what am I going to be excited to do when I'm 75 and still locked in the saddle doing the things that God's asked me and all of us to do? And that's why multi-site is a core strategy. I don't know if you know it or not, but most of our growth that's happening right now, numerical growth, is happening up in Mason. And why is numerical growth exciting? Numerical growth is exciting because it represents a life. A life that's getting connected with God and getting grafted into a community that's actually changing the world and making a big difference. Our largest growth is happening outside of the original Oakley campus, and this is the way it's going to continue to be in the future. We don't want to just have more and more people coming to a building. We want to be like Jesus, going to where people are, having a neighborhood presence, having an impact on that community, and enabling those of us who call Crossroads home to have a more convenient, likely place where our friends, our neighbors, our coworkers may attend church when they normally don't. And so that's why we do multi-site, to go where people are and build a larger base of infrastructure that can financially sustain some of the efforts we're doing to help people who are in need in our city and all across the globe. Now, why am I telling you this right now, and why am I standing here right now? Because I'm standing in a parking lot that is going to be Crossroads next site. Yes, it is, right here. Old Time Pottery, the former Old Time Pottery building, located in Florence, y'all. Yes, Florence, y'all. Florence, Kentucky is our next site. We know a little bit about taking empty big box space. And so we've taken this, we've actually closed on it, we actually own on it, and now we will be rehabbing it, bringing up to the standards of what we need to reach our friends and build people into a deeper level of understanding who Jesus is and having his power flow through us. It's 110,000 square feet. It'll be able to hold a 1,500 seat auditorium, and actually doing something this size in the long term is actually much more economically feasible and economically doable than a bunch of smaller places. So we're excited about this. We're excited that this location is in a place where 4,000 people who already call Crossroads home are in our database. And that's 4,000 people, not south of the river, but 4,000 people actually south of Covington, Fort Thomas, Newport. 4,000 people. Actually, as you take a look at our demographics on our map, this is the right site in the right location at the right time. We're looking to actually be able to open this thing up on March of 2012. So we'll be rehabbing, making this thing happen, and getting it ready. And if you live anywhere in the Northern Kentucky area, this is where you want to come. You want to come here because your friends are more likely to come here than at Mason or Oakley, and it's a community presence, and it's going to be a better presence, a better experience for you in your actual community in which you reside. So we're asking you to continue to pray for this. We're asking you to continue to just do life with your normal friends. We're asking you to continue to volunteer, get ready to volunteer. And let's all remember, the reason why we're fulfilling our game change commitments is because of amazing world-changing stuff that's happening like this. This actually changes the game of how we do ministry, how lives change, and how we have massive sustainability efforts all across the region. It is a great day to be in ministry, and I am excited about where we're going in the future, and I hope you are too.
We're going to Kentucky! We're going to Kentucky! God is moving. That's just another sign that God is moving and inviting us to be a part of this story that's playing out, and inviting our friends and neighbors and people who may be very far from Him at this point to come in and experience the love of this God. If you have questions on the Florence site, any of that, there's an FAQ prepared at the Info Center. Check that out. But I just want to root us again in where we're going in this series as you walk out the door. There's a scripture that for me is a prayer for all of us in this series. It's Ephesians 1, 17 and 18, and it says, I keep asking that the God of our Lord Jesus Christ, this glorious Father, may give you the spirit of wisdom and revelation so that you may know Him better. I pray also that the eyes of your heart may be enlightened in order that you may know the hope to which He has called you. There is a story that God has been writing. He's the central character, but He wants us to understand our place in the story. And He says of that place, there's a place of hope for us. That's where we're going in this series. I hope you'll come back for it. It's going to be awesome. Thanks for coming, everybody.